So as you can see, the topic of the presentation is language policy tools. So how to evaluate language policies. First of all, I'm pretty sure that it's going to be a redundant question, but it's nice to frame the problem from the start. So why do we need indicators? We all know that countries need to make choices in the field of language. Any sort of public good and service from filling in tax forms to register to healthcare providers, everything needs to be at least in one language. And we also know that there are the choices in language can create some disadvantages. We know that there are traditional minorities, ethnic minorities that have their own language, and with the globalization and increase in movement of people, the sociolinguistic and the demographic of countries have changed. So there are people that speak a variety of languages. We need to ensure that the effort that the individual are taken under fair and background condition. What does that mean? That we need to ensure that this the state that puts the individual in a position to make fair choices. And I'm not going to go too much into details of what states should do, because I think that is part of the presentation. But what am I going to talk about is how do we make sure that the choices that state make are just and efficient. The take that I have is that composite indicators, so the use of some statistics, is going to be it's fundamental to ensure and evaluate the performance of states. To do that, in my thesis and in my current work, I take a capability approach to linguistic justice, and I'm going to just talk a bit about it. I know that some of you are very familiar with the capability approach, some of you have used it in their own research, so I'm not going to be talking about the philosophical underpinnings too much, but just what I took from the capability approach and how I used it in my own dissertation. Let's take a step back, and again, I'm pretty sure that these concepts are going to be bread and butter for you, but they're going to come back under a different form. So whenever we study linguistic justice or linguistic disadvantage, whenever we study some sort of inequalities in language policies, we need to consider two factors, the linguistic environment and the linguistic repertoire. So the environment is the set of languages that are spoken in a given area, in a given state, but also in smaller jurisdictions, in regional autonomies, even in cities. And it's commonly defined as the context of the communication. Whereas the repertoire is more individual, is the set of languages that individuals themselves can speak, read, understand, write, use, sign, and the proficiency or in those activities. And it is the mean of communication. It's what individuals use to communicate. Language policy and planning intersects into these two elements. It is usually defined as rules aiming at modifying the status quo. So they intervene on the linguistic environment of the society. When does it happen that there is a linguistic disadvantage? And what I'm looking at more specifically, it's not the individual perspective, it's what the state does in managing multilingualism. We started from the premise that no country is completely monolingual, so due to globalization, open borders, migration, but also to the presence of historical minorities, linguistic environment of countries is quite diverse. So what can the state do to manage multilingualism in a way that is fair and efficient as well? So whenever there's a disadvantage, we assume that there's a disconnect between the environment and the repertoire. So the context where the communication happens does not match the individual's language repertoire, which cause miscommunication opportunities. There are language barriers that might also lead to broader social inequalities. Now, I haven't written it down here because I think it's fairly safe to assume, but whenever I talk about language barriers, I do not only refer to miscommunication opportunities. I don't refer only to a communicative aspect of language, but miscommunication opportunities can happen also for symbolic reasons. People might be very proficient in the majority language, but for identity and symbolic reason, they might want to use their preferred language, which might not be the majority one, to interact with the state. One example that it's very easy to imagine is going to the doctor. Even if someone is proficient in the dominant or in the majority language, they might feel more comfortable, and not only for a matter of proficiency in the communication aspect, but because they feel more comfortable on a more emotional level to talk with the doctor in their preferred language. That can be the minority language, the heritage language, depending on the groups. So whenever there is a disconnect in the communication, this can lead to broader social inequalities. I'm mentioning again the case of the doctor. If an effective communication between the doctor and the patient doesn't happen, there can be very serious consequences in terms of a misdiagnosis. But even if we leave the healthcare sector aside for a moment, if you imagine, for instance, having to fill in for a tax refund, or applying for social benefits, if there isn't a common language between the individuals and the state that it has agreed on to be the preferred ones, this can lead to missed opportunity also in terms of social benefits. I used to work in a social housing before I started the PhD, and there were so many cases of people that were rejected from social housing because they filled in the form in a wrong way, because they didn't really understood what was required of them. And that meant a very serious consequences of them not having a social housing. So again, what I'm focusing on is what the state can do. So we're looking at the state intervention in managing multilingualism in a way that eliminates inequalities, or at least provides compensation. What is the role of the state within the capability approach? So within the capability approach, and in general, if we think about the state in a public policy perspective, it's either an enabler or an agent. So it either makes sure through public policies to eliminate differences, so to solve the conversion problem is going to return afterwards, actually, but to eliminate all of the environmental differences that hinder people to actually interact and access public goods and services, or they can provide directly public goods and services. So in the sense of, again, in our example of healthcare, in that sense, the NHS or public healthcare is a public good, so it's provided directly from the state, whereas in terms of enabling, this falls under the all categories of, for instance, prohibiting discrimination based on language or on ethnicity, which are not directly a state intervention, but they create an environment where those discriminations cannot take place. So more generally, what is the capability approach? Again, I'm not going to go too much into details. This is a very the skeleton of what is the approach itself. So first of all, it's a philosophical but also economic perspective. it's based on the concept of justice as fairness. It builds on John's Rawls' fair background conditions and the idea of primary goods, even though then it moves forward. And basically, in the capability approach, the idea of justice is having equal access to opportunities or effective conversion of capabilities into functioning. Now, what are capabilities and functioning? In a nutshell, we define capabilities as everything that potentially we can be or achieve. And the functionings are those beings and doings that we want to achieve that are effectively taken into practice. So using Latin, if anyone here has studied Latin, it's between the in potentia and in acto, so in possibility and actual. So the capability approach puts the individual at the center. We examine whatever happens in state actions by looking at what individuals can actually do and be within a state. So going back to the idea of justice, a state is considered just whenever individuals can effectively turn these capabilities, so this set of things that they want to be or do, into effective functioning. A definition of like a set of capabilities, a list of essential capabilities, has not been there has been attempts to provide list of essential capabilities, but it is a very complicated matter. I've tried to do so within this research, but I want to put my hands forward and say that no list can be exhaustive, because every person has a different set of beliefs and needs. What we are looking at in terms of feasibility of analyzing what language policies are fair or not, we're gonna just narrow it down to the very essential beings and doings that are linked to state action. So this is just to say that this approach is very vast, and what I've taken is just a drop, and I've tried to connect it to language with always the idea of evaluating. So of course there's a lot of space for determining capabilities in sense of language at a broader spectrum. So how I've used the capability approach in my own research, I'm just going to give you some key concepts so to define linguistic disadvantage and then to measure, because my goal has always been to measure, to quantify as much as possible linguistic justice within countries. So we go back to the idea of language barriers. We said that this is a disconnect between environment and repertoire. So within this idea of beings and doings to be translated into functioning, we can identify the disconnect as a conversion problem. So whenever there's a language barrier, again, can be symbolic or communicative, people cannot actually translate those capabilities into functioning. No, they cannot access those potential communication opportunities, which then results into disadvantages that then spill over, as I said, to broader social inequalities. So where is the intervention of the state? The state goes to address this conversion problem. The state within the capability approach, as we saw before, it functions as an agent, but also as an enabler. So it has to do, the responsibility of the state here is to make sure that the environment is as equal as possible for people to access those communication opportunities. And this definition, linguistic justice is an environment where the beings and doings can be successfully achieved. So a working definition. In order to then operationalize this definition, as I said, these concepts are very much a work in progress. This is as much where I got with my PhD, which again I had the goal of evaluating. But if anyone here is interested in developing even further how to intersect language and linguistic justice and capabilities, I highly encourage it, because there's a lot to look in. So what I used as a working definition to go to this achieve this goal, this my personal goal of evaluating language policies. So I had to narrow down this infinite set of beings and doings that individuals can achieve into something that is linked to the actions of the state. So I identified language-based capabilities, which means are those set of capabilities that necessarily need language in order to be accessed. So are those set of beings and doings that absolutely need a language, either in writing, in speaking, in signing, but they need a language. This is important because, for instance, one of the fundamental capabilities that theorists are quite aware with it is life, so being alive. That doesn't necessarily require a language. But for instance, going back to the previous example, being healthy requires a language, because if you have an health condition and you cannot communicate with your doctor, that could result into not achieving the functioning of being healthy. So within this capability-based definition of linguistic justice, an environment is just if there it allows the effective realization of language-based capabilities. So this idea of linguistic justice allows the enjoyment of real language-related freedoms. And as I mentioned before, since the role of the state is in the conversion process, that's where we are gonna look to narrow down which capabilities we're going to look at. The last point in this theory, which is not related that much to evaluation, but it is connected to my overall framework, is that in this sense, I do frame linguistic disadvantage as a capability deprivation, which is not anything that I came up with. It was Andrew Shorten first. It's just to tie all everything together. If you're more interested in this specific work, I can then give you the references afterwards. So again, going to the really interesting part for me, at least, was how to build an index, because I said what I wanted to do was to evaluate. So I mentioned quite a few times now that we are looking at the state action, and why I said so insensitively, because the framework that I use is to look at language policies as public policy. So we look at public policy framework. It's a five-step process that breaks down every stage in the life of public policies, from the framing the problem, recognizing the question on the political agenda, formulating the policy itself, implementing it. But what I'm focusing on is the evaluation, so the final part. It has a very good, like, this approach has incredible pros, because it makes assessing the fairness of language choice from the state a bit more straightforward, although we lose a bit of the individual preferences. We are looking at a macro perspective here instead of a micro. How to select capabilities. So as I said before, now that we have identified what language capabilities are and how we can frame linguistic disadvantage as something that can be measurable, we have to select them. And as I was again mentioning before, capability selection is something that made capabilities scholars fight for decades. And this is again a series of techniques and methods that one can use not necessarily we're gonna reach to the same conclusion. In general, we do though look at either data-driven, so looking more at surveys, looking at word surveys such as World Bank database to look at what are the areas of impact. Public-based consensus, that is what I used, that is based on the idea that consensus is quite stable in time. So it's something that people have agreed on, and then it's going to last at least for a period of time. Of course, there's the usual qualitative, quantitative approach, such as participatory approach through focus group surveys gathering data that already exists. As I mentioned, I used a consensus-based approach. In particular, I used what is defined as the constitutional approach, which is a method in the capability approach school that has been used so far only to identify capabilities in terms of poverty. So it hasn't really been used for other spheres. So the capability approach is a big field that encompasses poverty studies, education studies, disabilities studies. So it's very broad, but this approach is fairly new. And as I said, it's based on public consensus. So we look at documents or shared norms and principles within a community or a society that we believe express what are the fundamental needs of that population. It was developed by these three scholars, Burki, De Muro, and Collar. And as again, it was mostly in the area of poverty studies. This is how it looks like as they have conceptualized it. So they start from this theory of public consensus. So in their analysis, they would look at the agreed norms, agreed in social norms, but also agreed legal norms, with the idea that a set of constitutional documents would encompass the values agreed and recognized by the people of such nation, but also international documents such as human rights conventions, covenant of public and covenant of political rights, social rights, all of that. So within the constitutional approach, in the methods, we derive those valuable beings and doings, so the capabilities from constitutions. In practice, through two steps. The first one is the interpretative content analysis of the constitution, so going through a sample of fundamental documents and analyzing what are the capabilities that emerge as fundamental, and then a second step to validate, which can be another public consensus approach, so looking at international norms, for instance, or participatory methods, so focus groups, interviews, and so on. What I've done in my thesis to select the language-based capabilities, so again, the ones that necessarily need a shared language between the state and the people to be enjoyed, I reversed it. I started from a public consensus approach, and I derived a preliminary list of language-based capability using human rights as a parameter of public consensus. Again, I know that this is it is not necessarily universal. Human rights are very much debated as being not necessarily universal. But as I said, the study has limitation, but I had to start from somewhere. In particular, I reviewed a list of language of capabilities based on human rights that Vizard has already analyzed, and I reviewed which one of those could potentially only need necessarily language to be enjoyed. And through that, I did a content analysis to test the effective presence of this preliminary set of language-based capability on a sample of 15 constitutions, trying to mirror as many as possible of geopolitical areas. if you, eccolo, if you're interested, these are the the areas that I look at. There are a couple of countries in North and Central and South America. I've tried to encompass also Asia, Africa, Middle East, and Europe. So the preliminary list of human rights and capabilities, again, that Wizard came up with, are the ones here in the slide. So coming from human rights analyzed through various conventions, including Inter-American System of Human Rights, Declaration of Human Rights, the Council of Europe documents, and so on. These are the capabilities that are deemed to be the essential ones. So expression of one's individual or group identity, access to healthcare with no discrimination, access to judicial system and court proceeding, access to education, access to public administration and essential services, which is linked to the right of equal opportunities. This is the way to put it more into operational way, and access to public deliberation, so representation and political participation. So from there, this table represents what are the dimensions, so the broader sphere of these capabilities, the capability itself, and what it means in practice. So because I know that the capability approach can be quite vague, these are the how these capabilities look like in practice. So if you're looking at expression of one's individual or group identity, that can be in practice speaking one's preferred language with no discrimination, or recognition of the language with official or special status, such as minority or minority status. Of course, for access to healthcare, it's way more simple. So it's accessing healthcare services in one's preferred language. For what it regards access to education, either attending bilingual schools, so where the preferred language is the mean of teaching, or at least learning it as a second language. And with regards to public administration and services, there's a variety of functioning here that can be identified. The ones that we are more interested in, because they're the ones that are really can make or break people's life. It's tax and revenues, job benefits, and so on. And in the last one is the access to public deliberation. So the actually being able to participate in the debate. So those are examples of how the functionings look like. Then from this general concept, how can we turn it into something that is manageable and measurable? As I said here, I took actually an approach that has been widely used in the capability approach. They do love composite indicators, and I turned each of these dimensions into a statistical indicator that could be used to actually measure the performance of the state through a variety of criteria, such as the availability of data, validity of in the representation of the phenomenon, and comparability. So if there were actually documents and data available throughout a variety of countries, and the indicators themselves are going to be expressed into a binary form, into 0 and 1, so we can calculate them and create ranking that is to make it easier to understand. These one are the indicators that I have developed again into my thesis. With regards to identity, there is three indicators that looks at enforcing the principle of non-discrimination, or protecting the status of the linguistic minorities, and on a more visual aspect, the presence or not of place names in the language of the minority. In terms of healthcare, I looked at two indicators. One is emergency language planning, such as the COVID material. This is because I carried out the thesis during the COVID pandemic, but now I've reworked this indicator as being preventative medicine in general. So not as much as emergency, but preventative. So for instance, information regarding also flu vaccine or vaccinations in general. And access to the general practice. This is a UK-based term, so it would be the family doctor. Judicial security, so the presence of translators and interpreters in the minority language. Education, it mirrors the functioning before, so either bilingual presence of bilingual school or teaching of the minority language as a second language. And for what regards equal opportunity and social inclusion, I've chosen two indicators to try to mirror different socioeconomic conditions. So the possibility to access benefits, here in the UK, we call it universal credits or unemployment, but other places call it unemployment benefits, anything that in that realm as a social security or income statement forms, so tax reports. And finally, for what regards of political participation, I looked at the presence of political party or parties that operates and campaign in the minority language. I have then tested these indicators into two case studies in the UK and in Italy, considering a variety of minorities, not only the traditional ethnic minorities, but also the new minorities, the groups that have been present in these countries for years and have, even though they are don't have the status of ethnic minorities, so the ones that are considered most commonly as migrant communities. As I said, these different indicators are fed by documents, and then they are translated into binary form, and then all the indicators are aggregated through an arithmetic mean. So what do you see now is the total value of the index over all these different identities, and accounting for the present of the yes or no present of the value for these indicators. I decided to use a visual representations, kind of a traffic light, where the green part is higher level of linguistic justice, the red one is lower level of linguistic justice, because I think it's very, I developed this index for policymakers, and I feel like this is a very easy way to immediately pinpoint where the minorities are. We can talk it up more, a bit more in the discussion, but as you can see, there's very important discrepancies with regard to traditional minorities within each country, and also for what regards new minorities, the performance is on the middle-lower tier for both countries. And that's it. So if you are interested in my research, I do have an article that explains a bit more the theoretical approach that I used, what I've tried to summarize. I'm not sure how accurately. And as I mentioned before, I am working to turn my thesis into a book. So stay tuned for that. But also, any feedback is going to be appreciated. Thank you very much for your attention. And these are my contact. Please do stay in touch if you want.